Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present George Naylor, president of the National Family Farm Coalition, who explains why thousands of activists have converged on Miami, Florida, to protest the meeting of delegates negotiating the Free Trade Area of the Americas Treaty. Nermeen Al-Mufti, an Iraqi journalist and historian, who talks about her current tour of the United States, where she is dialoguing with Americans about the reality of life in occupied Iraq. And environmentalist and author Bill McKibben, who discusses global warming and how climate change is adversely affecting life on Earth. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In early November, the Indonesian military extended martial law on the besieged island of Aceh. Peace talks broke down in May as the Indonesian army launched a major offensive against the rebel force of the Free Aceh Movement in the energy-rich region. After 6 months of fighting, human rights groups claim that over 300 civilians have been killed. 4,500 army troops and 5,000 rebels are fighting for control of Aceh. Indonesian President Megawati Sukarno-Putri has resisted calls by the United States, Japan, and the European Union to end the military emergency in Aceh. According to the New Internationalist magazine, this is just one example of rising human rights abuses in Indonesia. In the spring, army troops displaced 900 people on the island of West Papua while searching for weapons. Now human rights monitors say there are reliable reports of torture on West Papua. The military has been accused of obstructing the investigation of the murder of two Americans and an Indonesian in August of 2002. Last summer, 17 U.S. senators called on President Megawati to make a full report on the incident a national priority. Human rights activists are fearful of legislation that would give the Indonesian army unilateral authority to call out soldiers in case of an emergency. Pro-democracy forces worry that such powers could be used to stage a coup in the upcoming 2004 Indonesian presidential election. The 2004 presidential election is less than a year away, and Ralph Nader is gearing up for another run at the White House. The two-time Green Party candidate is working to set up a presidential exploratory committee that will allow Nader to raise money and hire campaign staff. Over the last 3 years, Nader has often been blamed by Democrats and labor leaders for costing Al Gore the presidency. Still, Nader is defiant in delivering an anti-corporate message at a time when most progressives agree on the mantra, "anybody but Bush." According to The Nation magazine, a new Nader candidacy would provoke opposition from the growing number of Green Party elected officials. Elizabeth Horton Scheff, the majority leader of the Hartford, Connecticut City Council, says Nader cannot appeal to black voters. And former Sonoma, California Mayor Larry Barnett says a new Nader campaign could hurt existing Green Party officials. Other Green Party activists suggest that Nader should focus on safe Democratic states to avoid being attacked as a spoiler. But the longtime consumer advocate told The Nation magazine, "It sounds to me like political schizophrenia. You either run or you don't. You don't say to people in some states, we'll ignore you." H&M, the trendy cheap chic Swedish clothing store, got a rude surprise when it opened its Chicago store on fashionable North Michigan Avenue. Several hundred union protesters greeted shoppers complaining about the retailer's labor practices in the United States. In cities across the country, Unite, the garment workers' union, is pressuring H&M to sign neutrality agreements not to oppose union organizing drives. Although the Swedish retailer is heavily unionized in Europe, it recently forced 200 distribution workers in New Jersey to sit through mandatory anti-union meetings and videos. According to the news magazine In These Times, Unite is actively organizing H&M's young retail workforce, a shift for the union which has recently focused on organizing commercial laundries and distribution workers. Many young retail clerks start out making the minimum wage, less than new workers in the distribution centers. Unite is linking up with powerful Swedish unions to put global pressure on image-conscious H&M. As union organizer Mary Kay Devine quipped, "Companies are going global. So is Unite." This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
as delegates from every nation in the hemisphere except for Cuba met in Miami, Florida, to negotiate the Free Trade Area of the Americas Treaty, tens of thousands of labor, farm, environmental, and student activists also converged there to voice their opposition to the proposed trade deal. Groups organizing the protests charged that the FTAA, like the North American Free Trade Agreement on which it is modeled, surrenders national sovereignty to corporations, leading to the erosion of democracy. The FTAA, which the Bush administration hopes to have in place by 2005, could incorporate trade regulations that will allow private corporations to sue governments for perceived loss of profit caused by labor or environmental regulations legislated by local, state, or federal governments. Other trade rules under discussion would enable transnational corporations to compete with publicly funded nonprofit institutions such as schools and hospitals. Much like the first FTAA summit in Quebec City in April 2001, protesters in Miami confronted a harsh police presence with basic civil liberties suspended for the duration of the meeting. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with George Naylor, president of the National Family Farm Coalition, who discusses the issues which brought thousands of activists to Miami and the common ground developed at the grassroots level throughout the hemisphere on issues such as agriculture policy.
Well, in general, these free trade agreements are intended to encourage trade liberalization and the deregulation of our economies so that really we, the people, have no control over how we engage in trade, what kind of environmental regulations we have, whether we have good labor laws or not, and how we organize our agriculture in each country so that we can have an agriculture that gives us food security and protects our environment and is sort of in keeping with the different countries' cultures. In general, we see it as an attempt by the United States acting in behalf of big corporations, not in behalf of the American people, but on behalf of these big corporations, to disempower the people so that these big corporations become more wealthy and more powerful at the expense of us and the environment.
George, I wonder if you would just go on to talk a little bit about subsidies. That is a big issue here in the United States, as it is throughout the world and the hemisphere,
right,
and seems to be a hot button issue for the political year. The election in 2004 certainly intersects a lot with farm subsidies, and a lot of farmers would be upset if those subsidies were pulled.
Yes, well, this issue of subsidies has gone around the world, and is like the crux of the whole matter, really. But there's a lot of misunderstanding about it, and I think that's partly due to the intentional misrepresentation of the issue by big business and by the media. What you must understand is that the subsidy system that we have, while it does keep some family farmers in business, and if we didn't have it, family farmers would be going broke. The subsidy system is not good for family farmers. We no longer have floors under prices for corn, soybeans, wheat, the other feed grains, or rice, or cotton. And so when the Chicago Board of Trade determines what the price is, well, they could determine that the price of corn and all these commodities is way below the cost of production. And farmers in modern times have to go borrow money to plant a new crop every year, every spring. So you can imagine if the price of corn, let's say, was already two-thirds of what the cost of production is, and you went into your banker and the banker would say, well, God, for all we know, it's going to go even lower. You know, we can't loan you any money. Well, under those conditions, virtually every farmer would go broke at the same time, which is obviously what corporations don't want to happen. So they like to buy the corn cheap, but it's incompatible with running a modern farm economy. So what they do is they let the price go cheap, and then they ask the taxpayer to pump in $20 billion to keep the farm economy operating. It keeps the farm economy operating, but farmers still go broke every day because even with the subsidies, they're not getting anywhere near the cost of production. And on top of that, the corn and the soybeans become manufactured animal livestock feed, which means now these big corporations that are raising livestock themselves, like Tyson and IBP and Cargill, they get to buy cheap livestock feed, which they can easily ship all over the world, at less than what it actually costs to produce. The family farmer can't compete with this industrialized livestock production anymore. And so they go out of business, and they quit raising livestock, and they plow up their hay and pasture and small grains to plant more corn and soybeans. There you can see a vicious circle right there, another race to the bottom that's a disaster for the land. and these big corporations get a stronger hold on food production. So it is a terrible disaster, and everybody that's listening to this program has a lot at stake in how we run our agricultural system and how these trade agreements will force other countries to follow our crazy lead.
You've talked with your counterparts, the farmers in Latin America, your counterparts.
Yes.
Do you find more conflict or common ground with them on these trade agreements, such as NAFTA and FTAA?
Even though we've sort of had to get over the hump of this theory that it was subsidies that caused low prices, because it's really the other way around. It was low prices that required subsidies, you see. Once we get that all settled, then we are totally on the same page and recognize that the market will not ever produce a fair price for farmers. That there has to be some sort of organized new institution, a governmental institution, a democratic institution, that makes sure that farmers will get a fair price, that they're not required to go out and abuse their land in order to try to make a living, you know, and that they also can be proud of the kind of food that they raise, and it'll be the kind of food that people want to eat and are confident in the safety of it.
Do you think the free trade area of the Americas treaty can be fixed, or would you like to see the whole thing scrapped and started from scratch?
Oh, I think it needs to be scrapped, because this thing, the way it's set up, it's intended to go in only one direction. The United States idea is it's our way or the highway. And so basically, unless you are able to totally change the philosophy of it, you know, it's just not going to make any benefit for anybody except multinational corporations. So I would say it's best to start over. And actually, what needs to happen is that people in the United States in particular need to take responsibility for what their own government is trying to foist on the rest of the world. And, you know, as far as that goes, how it orders our economy in the United States, which is not very darn good. So we need a new approach to trade.
That was George Naylor, president of the National Family Farm Coalition. Contact the coalition by calling area code 202-543-5671 or visit their website at www.nffc.net. In the face of increasing numbers of U.S. soldiers killed and injured in Iraq, the Bush administration announced a plan to speed up the transition from American rule to an Iraqi provisional government. The policy reversal came after the destruction of four U.S. helicopters in recent weeks and the launch of American military operations to more aggressively attack Iraqi insurgents. The White House says it intends to hold elections in Iraq during the first half of 2004, while maintaining a large U.S. military occupation force in the country for the foreseeable future. Meanwhile, international opposition to the U.S. occupation could be seen in the streets of London, where tens of thousands opposed to the war planned major protests against President Bush during his state visit to Britain. In Rome, thousands mourned the deaths of 19 Italian soldiers killed by a suicide bomb in Iraq. Illustrating the deep divisions in nations which have sent troops to aid the U.S. occupation was the resignation of an Italian counselor working with the U.S.-led administration in Baghdad, who criticized the Bush administration and called for a United Nations-led interim authority in Iraq. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Nermeen El-Mufti, an Iraqi journalist and historian who is currently touring the United States to participate in a dialogue with Americans about the reality of life in occupied Iraq. El-Mufti, whose trip is being coordinated by the Fellowship of Reconciliation, discusses the issues most important to Iraqis and her impression of the Americans she met.
We are here not representing anybody. We are two Iraqi women, witness of three wars. We are here just to show the Americans the reality and what the lies they are hearing every day.
What are your feelings about the U.S. invasion of Iraq? Certainly, the voices of average Iraqis are very absent from the U.S. media in giving us a sense of how average Iraqis are feeling about our country invading theirs.
It is a very painful feeling. I couldn't describe it. It was not invasion. It was invasion, aggression, then occupation. At this end, it is very hard to feel that you are injured in your dignity, in your sovereignty, in your country. And Iraq is not an ordinary country. Iraq has 15,000 years of history. Among it is 5,000 years of written history. Iraq introduced the first letter. And my country was invaded because President Bush said there are weapons of mass destruction in between hand of the madman, him and Saddam. And after 2 months of occupation, they found nothing. They began to search about programs of weapons of mass destruction. And they sent David Kay. David Kay was the most top inspector in Iraq under UNSCOM. And he found nothing. He presented his report to President Bush saying there is not even a single program for weapons of war, for producing weapons of mass destruction. Now they are searching for proposals for programs for producing weapons of mass destruction. Now, 6 months or the 7 months of occupation, giant battle is in Iraq, and that United States occupation forces and civilian administration is there, and never even single building did rebuild, wasn't rebuilt or reconstructed again. What could I feel? What could the Iraqis feel? It's not a matter of salaries or electricity or water. Everything is easy to gain it if you feel that you are free. We are not free. This feeling is very enough to hurt our hearts. It's occupation and very brutal occupation. Yeah, and just this morning, my mom called me from Kirkuk. I'm originally from Kirkuk. And she informed me that since 2 days, Kirkuk has been bombed by missiles, by rockets, by everything, saying that Saddam followers are there. And they're destroying everything for nothing because they didn't find Saddam and they didn't find nothing and they occupied us. Every day many Iraqis are being killed in the streets through two things, friendly fires, that the American fires, because the Americans are very afraid, their fingers are on the triggers always, so any moment they are going to kill any Iraqi. Again, the Iraqis are being killed by those suicide bombers who are detonating car bombing everywhere. So how could I feel all other Iraqis feel?
Our president tells the American people that regardless of the fact that weapons of mass destruction have not been found, the fact that Saddam Hussein, a dictator, was removed from power will be, in the long run, a benefit, a blessing to the Iraqi people. How do you respond to that kind of justification that we have from the White House?
It isn't justification. There's no justification. Saddam Hussein was brutal, no doubt in that. Saddam Hussein was dictator, no. It is a reality. But why didn't President Bush ask Rumsfeld, why did he come to Iraq in 1984 and shook hands with Saddam Hussein twice in his palace? Many, many American delegations from Congress, businessmen Americans, visited Iraq till 1989. For what? They were friends. So if he was a dictator, they provided him by weapons and intelligence information and report during Iraq-Iran war. They helped him. They support him to protect their interests in Iraq, in the area and Gulf states in the Gulf area. All of a sudden, he became dictator. He was dictator from the first year he ruled Iraq. I don't know in which way, but it was our work. You know, it was our job to topple him, not the Americans. No any single independent country or state or nation can allow for a foreign power to come to topple its regime. It is nation's business, not the other's business.
Do you have faith in the handpicked leaders that the United States has put in place there to make this transition from occupation to sovereignty?
No, because so-called governing council appointed by the Americans themselves and most of the members of that council, they were gifted. It was as a gift for them to be members because they supported Americans to invade Iraq and to occupy Iraq. It was just a reward for them, as a gift for them. It is not interim government, is not transition to the Iraqi sovereignty or to the Iraqis. I think the first United Nations organization should be back to Iraq to just organize a scientific, systematic election.
What is your message that you bring to Americans as you travel around the country here? And what is the most memorable interaction you've had with U.S. citizens as you speak with individuals around the country?
For 13 years, we were demonized. 26 million Iraqis were demonized. We have just say we are human beings, we are the grandchildren or those great Iraqis who built civilization. We are here to shake hands with the Americans. We are here to say to the Americans, try to protect your sons. We are here to say that we are against any Iraqi or American being killed more in Iraq. It is pity. Here I am astonished. Every day I am meeting very noble, very generous, very hostile Americans. Half of them are already knowing what is going on in my country because they are peace activists, they are participating in the demos against war, and the other half is trying to understand. I never forget a young student in Santa Clara University told me, thanks, you succeeded in planting a seed of doubt on my brain. I think this is a good thing, and they are helping themselves to understand.
That was Iraqi journalist and historian Nermeen Al-Mufti. For more information on the Women of Iraq tour, contact the Fellowship of Reconciliation by calling area code 845-358-4601 or visit their website at www.forusa.org. In 1989, environmentalist Bill McKibben wrote The End of Nature, the first book about global warming written for a popular rather than a scientific audience. He noted some of the changes already apparent from global warming and predicted the dire consequences if the world didn't reduce its use of fossil fuels. He concluded the book by writing, "The only thing we absolutely must do is cut back immediately on our use of fossil fuels." Since then, the world, both developing and industrialized nations, have significantly increased their use of fossil fuels. The vast majority of climatologists agree that global warming is a real phenomenon, not just a theory, and recent events, like sustained record-high temperatures and the massive die-off of the world's coral reefs, continue to drive that reality home. However, most people still don't see global warming as directly impacting their lives. Now, at the end of 2003, the U.S. Congress is poised to pass a comprehensive energy bill. While the legislation does not permit oil drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, which was a litmus test for support or opposition in previous versions of the bill, it is seen by many as a giveaway to the fossil fuel and nuclear power industries. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus recently spoke with Bill McKibben about the current state of the Earth's climate, its impact on humans, and what he thinks can be done at this stage to alter a worst-case scenario.
You know, we no longer probably should talk about global warming or climate change as something that's coming in the future. It clearly is here on top of us now. This summer in Europe, they recorded the highest temperatures that they'd ever recorded, in some cases 7, 8, 9 degrees Fahrenheit hotter than it had been before. And in the course of that summer, something like 25,000 Europeans died. These people were just exactly like us. They had modems and refrigerators and telephones and all the accoutrements of a modern life. Their bodies were just not prepared to cope with that kind of temperature. We see all kinds of big changes now occurring in the natural world. Every glacial system in the world is in rapid retreat. Arctic ice is about 40% thinner than it was 40 years ago. This is with about 1 degree Fahrenheit of global warming, human-caused global warming. The temperature is about 60 degrees globally average now, up from about 59 degrees. It doesn't sound like much, but it turns out that the Earth's physical systems are finely balanced, and that small changes indeed can yield large results. And now the climatologists tell us that without dramatic changes in the ways that we power our lives, this century we'll see a further increase of best guess, not the worst case scenario, best middle course guess, about a further 5 degrees Fahrenheit before 2100. Just to give some frame of reference, I mean, the Earth hasn't been that warm, as far as anyone can tell, for 300 or 400 million years. The temperature goes up, wind speeds increase because they follow, pressure gradients, borders between warm and cold. Sea levels rise because warm water takes up more space than cold water does. Seasons begin to shift in dramatic ways. Ice melts, on and on and on down the list. Only, volcanic and tectonic forces are left largely untouched by human beings at this point.
Living in the United States, I guess I would have to say that I still don't, and, with an ever-increasing sale of SUVs and with a president who, seems determined to develop every possible form of fossil fuel and ignore many of the other ways of reducing the use of such fuels, which increase global warming, it does seem to me here that people are either just being willfully blind or just don't want to bother to think about it. How do you shift that balance? I mean, your book was obviously an important contribution to the debate, but, that was almost 15 years ago, and it's kind of mind-boggling to think that we're still selling more SUVs than ever. The SUVs didn't even exist 15 years ago, I don't think.
That's right. 15 years ago, when people would say, what can we do about this? I would say, and others would say, well, we could drive smaller cars and drive them less. And you're right. That didn't accomplish very much. We now drive much bigger cars and drive them much more. It is worth saying that the Earth, as seen from the United States, is not the whole picture. Other places are doing interesting things. I mean, the rest of the industrialized world has signed on to this Kyoto Treaty and are now making serious long-term plans for dramatically reducing their carbon emissions. The UK, Holland, France, all have talked about and put forth plans for 50 and 60% reductions in CO2 emissions over the next generation or two. It's probably not quick enough or quite large enough, but it's certainly dramatic evidence that people there are taking these things seriously. In our country at the moment, under Vice President Cheney's new energy policy, Americans are projected to increase their CO2 emissions on the order of 40% in that same period over the next generation or two. Public policy in this regard is immature to the point of, well, almost of insanity. We just can't bring ourselves to begin making the public policy choices that we need to make. We clearly need to make fossil fuels more expensive and to do it quickly. And I must say, it's been a largely bipartisan effort. The Clinton administration, where people really knew about, at some level cared about these things, presided over a 15% increase in our CO2 emissions as a nation, largely because we did nothing to stop the conversion to SUVs. At the moment, we're in a complete disaster. I mean, the current occupant of the White House seems determined not only to ignore the situation, but to make it worse in every way that he can. And so, you know, job one is clearly his defeat at the polls next November. But that in and of itself is unlikely to get us very far in this particular fight. I mean, job two is figuring out how we're going to mature quickly into this discussion.
That was environmentalist and author Bill McKibben. For more information, go to his website at www.billmckibben.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Bill Cosentino, Sasha Summer Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.